What's up, my people? Welcome to Fellowship Bible Church's Sermon Spotlight, where we're coming at you each and every week with a fresh weekend, a debrief, an effort to send a biblical truth. And what better way to do that than by the power of conversation? I'm one of your hosts, Caleb Pearson. Joining me in the host spotlight, Miss Abby Lindeberg. Abby, how are you?
Good.
Good. You? Thank you for being here. Flipping through the pages of his Bible already, Mark Carey. Mark, how you doing, buddy?
Very well.
Good.
Yep.
Hey, thanks for bringing the word of the Lord, you know what I mean, to this podcast. Thanks for grounding us in the ultimate goal.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ground that needs to happen.
Absolutely. So, guys, what I want to do is jump right in to a Sunday in review, covering some ground in Daniel chapter 2. We've kind of had some questions come in to the podcast and come up as well that we'll discuss, but what I'd like to do is, Abby, come your way first. Initial thoughts, I'll share, Mark as well, and then we'll toss out a question or two. So, Abby, what was it like this past weekend unpacking Daniel 2 for you?
Yeah, it felt very much like a history lesson in a good way. It was a lot of context historically that I appreciated, and even just like tying in the different empires that I don't know, I didn't like history growing up, so hearing it from that perspective, I'm like, oh, these things kind of mattered, and it makes sense now hearing it in the story.
Yeah, that's good. I appreciate that as well. I think you like history. I think you're a history buff. So I can tell this is kind of in your realm of like, okay, he's going to lean into the history of it all. And I do like also, and almost get this from your perspective too, Abby, but how it does support what we already know about world history and what's documented in other places as well. I find that the canonicity of scripture, it helps in that realm when you start to realize, okay, like, these stories aren't just fun fiction for Christians to feel better about what they believe. It actually all does factor into what scientists have always discovered to be historical fact, which is cool too. Mm-hmm. So I guess to come your way, Mark, have you felt that as you've been studying it? Have you even taught on Daniel before or tied into the history of it? What has that journey been like for you?
Well, definitely. I mean, I have studied and taught Daniel a little bit before. But doing it again, I do enjoy history, but what the study of Daniel does is makes you realize again, it's real space time. This is, you know, the old saying is history is his story. Mm-hmm. And you see the sovereign God moving in the great powers of the world and at a macro level, but it also involves individual people and, you know, just it's just kind of exciting, I think, to see how God is unfolding things. Mm-hmm. One person after one of the services this last week and made the comment of, I'm not necessarily always enjoying history in school, but being it brought to their attention again that what we read in the Bible does take place in real, again, space-time events of people, and it's real, and that's helped them get a little bit more of the realness of the Bible.
Yeah. So. I remember, I don't know how old I would have been, but you were given a sermon way back when and mentioned Caesar at some point, and I remember thinking, whoa, why is he talking about what my history teacher's talking about?
I think you were three at the time because I saw you raise your hand and go, yeah, amen.
Three. Yeah. I would have been asleep if I was three. But it's always cool when that kind of, because I think that's a light bulb moment that needs to happen over and over again, especially if we approach scripture with such a spiritual element of like, okay, Lord, let this summon in me something supernatural and incredible moving forward, certainly possible. But also it's a taste of appreciation for, okay, this is what it was like for them.
Yeah.
And anything I could possibly find about this era will support it.
And, of course, it was a limited time in terms of communion and all the other things that we had.
Sure.
So it was a shortened sermon anyway. But, man, I could have gone into so much more detail about it. It's brief in here. Like in verse 39, it just, and after Babylon, will arise another kingdom and fear you, and then another kingdom. I mean, it's like eight words. Mm-hmm. Well, within that eight words are decades of time. Mm-hmm. And there really is some interesting, the whole movement of God in that. There's, you know, the Esther, the story of Esther fits in there. Mm. When the Persians, you know, mm-hmm. the people are back in the land, but there were Jews that were left over. Well, that whole story of Esther, or I had mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Nahum the prophet went up to Nineveh, focused on Nineveh, mm. back when Nabopolassar, you know, conquered the Babylonian chieftain, conquered Nineveh from the Assyrians. Mm. Well, Nahum wrote to those people, real people in real time, warning them about that. Well, then whatever it was 100 years before that, it was Jonah who'd gone up to Nineveh. I mean, real people, real cities, real mm-hmm. space-time events. And so it's
well, that's
it's
good.
Fascinating.
And, yeah, and what that actually does is bring us to a question we kind of had submitted. You're talking about the gold, silver, bronze, and iron, and the dream, and the statue, and I appreciate the visual you provided for that. The question we got was, how do we know that the gold, silver, bronze, and iron of the dream were those empires, such as Greek and Roman, etc.? Like there have been a ton of different world powers and empires, and if you were to try to Google and research or tie them together, like Google Iron Empire, a lot of resources say it's the Assyrian Empire. So how did we get that mm-hmm. it was the Roman Empire, vice versa? What leads us to conclude?
Yeah, because the text, like verse 39, mm-hmm. Well, he tells you, so you are the head of gold. So that's a no-brainer.
We know where it
Babylon,
starts.
So you know the mm-hmm. starting point. And then it says, and after you will rise another.
So the immediate.
You just look at your history books, and the next after that was the Medo-Persians, and then after that, mm-hmm. so the history books kind of tell us.
So it's sequential. We're not like skipping certain empires so it fits. It's actually right
it's
after
just
the other.
Right after the other. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no need to go beyond that because it just, mm-hmm. it's all laid out there in history. Now, it is interesting, and I didn't have time, and it's not necessary to mention this in a sermon, but Daniel's is so specific. After you will rise another kingdom, and then another, and another. He's so clear, and he even gets clearer when you go to chapter 7 and 8, he'll spend even more time, that liberal scholars who don't really believe in a supernatural God who could tell what's going on in the future, they said there's no way that Daniel could have written this in the 5th century BC, because it is so exact. Mm-hmm. So what they will do is... some of the more liberal commentaries on Daniel will say, well, obviously, again, Babylon is the head of gold. He tells us that. But then they'll say the next kingdom that arises is the kingdom of Media, the Medes, which did exist, the Medes. And then after the Medes would have been the Persians, which was in 539, and Daniel lived to see that. And then after the Persians was Greece. And though Daniel wouldn't have lived to see that, so you had Babylon, the Medes, the Persians, and the Greeks. So they're trying to force it into a lifetime that Daniel. And if you can't do that, then you'll just say, well, Daniel didn't write it. Someone in the like the second century BC was mm-hmm. looking back and writing about this. Mm-hmm. And they would still come up with Babylon, Medes, Persians, Greece, because that was all past history.
Right.
Rome wasn't there yet. It was just, there were city-states and different things with Rome. I mean, it wasn't it wasn't the powerhouse of an empire, mm-hmm. like till later, till Julius Caesar, really, in the first century BC. So they said, there's no way that Daniel would have written this, because it's mm-hmm. so exact. And so it must have been someone just prior to while Greece was still, or the four generals were still ruling, and so they could look back instead of anticipating looking forward. It removes all of the supernatural God who was actually showing Daniel in a dream the future.
Well, what it is is the wrong way to handle a hard text. let's try to restructure the whole book so that this passage makes sense.
But the reason we can go empire after empire after empire, we can say Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, is because it says in verse 39, and after you there will arise another kingdom, mm-hmm. and then you just look at history, and it just fits. Mm-hmm. It fits beautifully. Now, I did mention that you decrease in quality from gold, mm-hmm. silver, the King James uses the word brass, bronze. And one thing I double checked on that, brass as a metal wasn't really discovered
there yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there yet. So old King James, it was written 1611, but they use brass. But bronze would have been the term anyway. Mm-hmm. And then iron. Can you look at these world empires and see, is there kind of a decrease in terms of the austerity of the wealth? And I do think you can. I didn't get into that, but Babylon, I read someplace that for centuries later, people are digging up gold, the gold of Babylon. I mean, what Nebuchadnezzar did in his 40 years of rule and what he built in Babylon in the ancient city.
The shiny fellow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was the head of gold. Mm-hmm. And the opulence and the magnificence of that was unmatched by anything. Now, the silver, Medo-Persian, there's also something I read about the coinage. And so like Medo-Persian, the silver, and I can't remember the term, it wasn't drachma, but the silver coins of the Medo-Persians, they minted so many silver coins that they were known, you know, so there's some tie in there with silver. It wasn't the opulence like Nebuchadnezzar had in ancient Babylon. Nothing that the Medes and the Persians built would have been considered one of the seven wonders of the world. But certainly in its strength, so it decreases in quality, but it increases in strength as time goes on. And this combined Medo-Persia, the Persians assimilated the Medes in 549 and then conquered Babylon in 539. So there was kind of this co-rulership thing. Persia was clearly the dominant, but there were the Medo-Persians, the two arms, the silver. It's clearly there. But then when they are overtaken by Alexander the Great, again, you don't have necessarily the opulence and the beauty that Babylon, ancient Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar was. But the strength of and the empire of Babylon was what Alexander the Great did is startling. I mean, what he accomplished in terms of the strength of and the force that he went out as a young 20-something-year-old guy. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And same thing with Rome. I mean, you cannot, the iron of Rome, the strength of Rome. Now you can look back and see ancient Rome and the Colosseum and stuff, but it wasn't like overlaid with gold and things like that. It's just, so there's a decrease in quality and yet an increase in strength. And history bears that out. You just can't, even the liberal scholars have to, you know, they've got to say, well, this must have been written later because.
How would he know?
He pegged it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think in your sermon you said value instead of quality. So in terms of value, decreasing in value, would you say that's more like what they valued, maybe also like decreased? Like it went from this is what makes us rich kind of thing to this, to then down in Rome is more like having conquered all this is what makes us wealthy.
Yeah. And probably the better term, not value, would have been, you know, the opulence or something of it. I do think it's interesting that Nebuchadnezzar, he did stop conquering, and focused internally and built all this stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like, well, enough's enough. And I, you know, there are reasons historically. So,
well, you conquer so many nations, you can have your hands full.
As Alexander the Great found out. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'd like to talk more about that. But yeah, what Alexander the Great did. But then, you know, Rome. Yeah, it's all a fascinating study of world history. You cannot understand world history, ancient world history, apart from seen God moving in all that. And Daniel is just in short little phrases and
there are
sentences.
There's some well-documented, I don't know what you would call it, conversions of historians that dive so deep into it that they do realize this Christ guy, he's the real deal. Yeah. So it's fascinating how people not interested in, they go out to disprove this.
Yeah.
And they end up getting to a point where they're like, oh.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
What I also hear you saying is the people that didn't like history in school just needed the Bible. They just realized there was a piece missing. That's all they needed.
There's a piece missing.
They should have had Mr. Carey.
Right.
Do you think, I don't expect you to know this answer, but would there have been anybody in Rome going like, we're the fourth in line. Daniel was right. We're the iron. Or I wonder how many people were aware and tracking.
I think, you know, I read somewhere, and you'll have to check on this, I think Josephus made a comment and understood that Rome was the fourth. And
What it could have been like for somebody in one of those empires to be vested in stuff like this, to where they're like, oh, that's us. Like, that's crazy to me.
Yeah. Well, and it doesn't say it in the New Testament very clearly, but when we did our study in the book of Acts, you know, we mentioned numerous times that Jesus taught for 40 days after he was resurrected about the kingdom. Well, obviously that'd be, because they could go through their history. They knew Babylon had come, Medo-Persia, Greece. They were in Rome, the Roman Empire. And so when the disciples asked Jesus in chapter 1, verse 6, is it now that you're going to restore the kingdom? Is the stone coming to crash all these other? That's what their hope was,
right?
That this was going to happen. I think that was, and I think even in Second Temple literature of, you know, the century or and a half before Jesus's birth, there was an awareness of this flow of world histories, and it was like, so a lot of messiahs were showing up, and you know, maybe claiming to be, hey, I'm the stone. Or stoned,
right,
and so there was somewhat, I think, of an awareness and a hope that this was the coming. Now, Daniel and the prophets of old, they never really saw the first coming and the second coming. We've talked about that there was it was all one. You know, the king is going to come, put an end. I mean, in the days of those kings, this is going to happen. That's what Daniel said. Not understanding, like two mountain peaks, and there was a big gap, chasm of time in between the two mountain peaks, so the first coming and the second coming. And so that's another question. I wonder how disillusioned, what's happening when all of a sudden the persecution set in, and, well, wait a minute, we thought, or then when Jerusalem is destroyed by Titus and the Jews, but God's people are scattered all over. What's going on here? We thought this would all end.
Sure.
You know, the stone not cut by hands is supposed to come and destroy.
You can see how we could just keep studying it, keep talking about it.
Yeah.
Dive into these rabbit holes. I did want to devote some time. I know we have a time constraint to this question that you have, Abby. Kind of about age. Age has been coming up since we started Daniel, really. But
Yeah, you mentioned Daniel's age a lot, specifically that he's probably around 18. And I know, like, in today's culture, it can kind of go either way. Some people value youth. Some people are kind of like, oh, that punk kid. Mm-hmm. So would there have been any connotation there to his age? I mean, it's the greatest empire in the world. There's that opulence, like you were saying. So him presenting himself to the king, is there any kind of connotation there to his age, or even how he rose up in the ranks at his young age? Would there have been conflict there?
A really good question. So let's start with what we do know. We do know that Nebuchadnezzar's kind of his modus operandi was to conquer a people and then take
moldable
young, strip them from the land and take them back and continue to mold them after his own image, and then place them in places of service, maybe with their own conquered people, but they would have been well indoctrinated, you know, in the ways, and would have probably bought into their type of brainwashing techniques. So we know that is what he was after, was young people that were moldable. We also know that Daniel, his captivity was at least 70 years. So he wasn't taken as a 2-year-old,
right?
Or so he must have been, and it would have been typical to have been taken as a young,
right,
tween. he didn't have those concepts.
A healthy prospect.
Mm-hmm. And we know the facts are that it was in Nebuchadnezzar's second year of his reign, and I tried to explain a little bit. There's an ascension year. He probably co-reigned with Nabopolassar, his father, for 1 year, and then he ascended alone, and so, you know, mm-hmm, it might have been his third or fourth year. But so we do know that Daniel was probably mid-teens or something. It's an educated guess that, mm-hmm, that's where he was. And so when he interpreted the dream and all this, he can't be much more than 18, mm-hmm, 17, 18 years old. And why is that significant? Now, this is, so we have to read a little bit into some things, into some other texts. In the Torah, the first five books of Moses, and I think it's in the book of Numbers. I didn't double check this, but to be a priest, you had to be at least 25 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think in the Chronicles, maybe it was under King David, but somewhere later, it bumped it up to 30. So there is some age limits in terms of when you can, yeah, serve. Now, I think under King David, you could serve in the army when you were 20. Mm-hmm. We know that, say, in the Exodus, everybody 20 and above were died off in the wilderness. Everybody, I guess you could say 19 or 20 and below, were able to enter into the promises. So there was some age of like almost of accountability age that you really hadn't entered into adulthood until you were 20 to enter military service and 25 to 30 to be a priest. So here's a young guy who maybe was 17, 18 years old. So yes, even in that culture, that would have been looked upon as very, I think, unique. Nebuchadnezzar's training was for 3 years. We learned from chapter 1, verse 5. So they thought they could do a lot in 3 years, which would, I think, assume that these were younger, right, men. Mm-hmm. They were more moldable. Yeah. If they were a little older, probably would have taken 5 or 8 years, you know. So I do think it was unusual. But why would Nebuchadnezzar elevate such a young guy to such? Because all his older wise guys had failed to interpret the dream, mm-hmm, or not just interpret, to even know the dream.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't do it.
They couldn't do it.
Give me somebody who can.
And I do think Nebuchadnezzar had already interviewed Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, and knew these guys were 10 times better than the other counselors that had been going through training. So there was already an awareness of these Jewish boys. They were standouts. Mm-hmm. And so when Arioch, the captain of the bodyguard, comes to Nebuchadnezzar and says, I found somebody who knows your dream and can interpret it, I don't think it was that big of a shock. Oh, that Jewish boy, yeah, I'll listen to him because he's distinguished himself already. Hmm. And so he heard it, and when Daniel asked for time to, I'll get back to you on this, Nebuchadnezzar was willing to do it because Daniel had, so I think at that point, Nebuchadnezzar's saying, I don't care if he's 10 or 20.
Yeah.
If he knows the dream and can interpret it, and I already know he's got it in, something's different with this kid. Mm-hmm. So they, yeah, and then to raise him, it probably speaks a lot to Nebuchadnezzar, other than the fact, though, that he was absolutely thrilled. We the turmoil that he must have been facing, mm-hmm, over this dream, mm-hmm, and then to have it told to him and then interpreted, he was overjoyed.
Gratitude.
And he had told, I will gift you multiple times over. And he was good, mm-hmm, to his word.
Interesting.
And so why not put a kid who's 18 years old over all the wise people.
Yeah.
And he had experience now.
Yeah. Yeah. So, course, that raises a question when you're preaching on chapter 3. Where was Daniel when his buddies are thrown into the...
And you throw some astrologers into the mix, you realize people could wrestle with his age all they want. They were also mad about his religious background and his identity, too.
Yeah. Does that answer the question, I think?
Yeah. Okay. It's good. But guys, I am going to end us there. Do you want to share briefly where we're headed this weekend, Mark, before we jump into Daniel 3?
Well, I think it's quite easy to say Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Everybody pretty much accepts that it's true. Then you got into the mix of clay and 10 toes.
Right.
And there was some, I didn't mention this in the first service, and someone mentioned it to me afterwards. And I was kind of trying to cut some things short. So I added it in the second service where it said in the interpretation in verse 43, and in that you saw iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men. They will not adhere to one another. All translations say it somewhat similarly. The ESV actually says something to the effect they will be mixed in marriage, and it uses the word marriage. Hmm. And I have to take issue with the ESV on that point because the word marriage isn't in there. Mm-hmm. It's an assumption. Mm-hmm. Words similar, the mingling with the, literally, the seed of men, and so they just
assumed
it and put the word marriage in there. Hmm. So...
we'll unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit more maybe, but at least in the first service, I didn't mention that there was some real concerns about that, that it could even be satanic, demonic, like in Genesis 6,
sure,
where demonic realm came in. So we don't know that much about that. What is this feet? And then the toes... And then it's in the age of days of that, of those kings. This, what is that? That the kingdom comes. And what is this kingdom? So I'm going to unpack a little bit more about the coming kingdom. And in the, you know, some people would say we're already in the kingdom.
Right.
And that's amillennialism, that we are in the kingdom. And we are, teacher, premillennial, because we're talking about the kingdom that's yet to come. Mm-hmm. So what's going on here? And I just wanted to unpack that a little bit more.
Yeah, very good.
So that'll be coming up.
Looking forward to it. Mark, thank you for being here.
Mm-hmm.
Brother, I appreciate it. Abby, thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's awesome. As a reminder to our viewers and listeners, remember that we love to hear from you. You can head over to fbcva.org/podcast and write us your note and comments. The fact of the matter, everybody, is that sermons are not meant to just take an hour, but rather transform a lifetime. Till next week, much love. God bless.